Today, we have a very special guest. Matt Chapman is joining us on the Skybound RC podcast. Matt is an American Airlines captain flying the Boeing 737 and an avid RC pilot. He's also an accomplished full-scale robotic pilot, boasting numerous competition successes, including a remarkable third place in the 1998 World Robotic Championships. After his competitive career, he's continued to captivate millions at major US air shows and has showcased unique RC and full-scale combined formation demos. In 2009, he even worked with Hobico to develop and release an RC model replica of his own full-scale Eagle 580. Today, he's still passionate about RC planes, and we're diving into all things aerobatics and aviation with him. Matt Chapman, hello. Thanks so much for taking the time, and welcome to the Skybound RC podcast.
Thank you. It's great to be here. I appreciate the invitation to join you.
Yeah. Pretty excited to talk to you. In the past, we've had a couple of guests that are very well known in the RC world. I think you're a particularly interesting person to talk to that has been very involved in both full-scale aviation and RC at pretty high level. Why don't you give us a quick intro about yourself for those people that might not have heard of you?
Sure. I'm honored to be here because I saw you had Chase Ducia on recently. So to be on the same program as Chase with his high level of expertise and whatnot in the world, I'm flattered to be included in that. My name is Matt Chapman. I've been flying radio control aircraft since I've been about 14, 15 years old. So many, many years ago. I learned to fly real airplanes, full scale, in 1979, and put the model airplanes aside while I did that. Ended up becoming a flight instructor and started building a Pitt Special, a real airplane, to become an airshow pilot. That was always my dream as a child growing up, was to fly airshows. So building the Pitts and getting into the airshows led to aerobatic competition, led to also a career in aviation. The professional side, I was a charter pilot. I was an air ambulance pilot. Then I flew corporate for a little over a year. And then in 1987, I was hired at American Airlines, where I still am, 36 years later, presently a captain on a 787 out of Philadelphia flying international routes. From a aerobatic standpoint, I flew competition for 17 years. I made the United States aerobatic team two times and competed in two World Aerobatic Championships, the first in Oklahoma City, the second in Trenčín, Slovakia. That was a great championships for me personally. I placed third overall in the world and led the U.S. men's team to a silver medal behind the French. So that was my kind of crowning accomplishment in the world of competition aerobatics. Then I went on to continue airshow flying for several more years. I did airshow performing for 37 years total in the pits in a home-built laser, very similar to Leo Loudenslager's airplane. And then finally, the airplane that I was probably best known for in the model airplane world anyway, the CAP 231EX Eagle 580. It went by a couple different names. And then I finished up my airshow career flying an extra 330LX, being sponsored by Embry-Riddle. I was with them for 13 years of my airshow career. Pretty much full-time for the last 15 to 20 years, I've been flying radio control. Interestingly, my discipline in RC that I love the most is scale airplanes. World War II, some older biplanes. I'm into turbines now. And everybody always asks me why I don't fly iMac. And the simple answer is I suck at it.
I imagine it's pretty different from full-scale aerobatics.
It is. Translating what I do here to this and what I see they're two different things. And the amount of respect I have for really good iMac competitors is immense because it is so difficult to do really well. But that's my background in a nutshell.
Yeah, no, they flipped down a lot in aviation. You mentioned that Pitt Special that you built pretty early on, right? Like basically when you were already an instructor, I think.
Yes, I built that, started the project in probably 1980, finished it in 1983, and with a grand total of about 20 hours of aerobatic time in the pits, self-taught, I did my first air show.
Was that Pitts your first aerobatic airplane? Did you get any like flight training, aerobatic training in some other airplane, or was... Did you go head first into the pits?
Almost head first in the pits, but another friend of mine and I had access to a super decathlon. Mm-hmm. And neither of us knew how to fly aerobatics well. So we flew with each other and basically taught each other and experimented with various things together. Didn't kill ourselves doing this. This is not how I would recommend to anybody how you learn aerobatics. But, you know, 40 years ago, there was not a lot available for dual aerobatic instruction. Mm-hmm. So, and the fellow I flew with, his name was Ray Speicher. He's no longer with us, but Ray had a Pitts himself and kind of mentored me through the building of my airplane. And I actually flew my first air show with Ray in, I think it was Hagerstown, Maryland, years ago.
I have just a little bit of full-scale experience in aerobatics. I've only done some very basic aerobatics in Citabria, and I've always felt like taking that step towards something like a Pitts feels like a really intimidating step. Like I always hear people talk about how difficult that plane is to land, how much more nervous that plane is in aerobatics in general. I mind that transition must have been pretty tricky, right? From your the time in the super decathlon to the pits.
I wasn't experienced enough to sense the difference in performance and difficulty, and I was a 23-year-old fearless pilot, so I never looked at it in terms of what was difficult or what wasn't. But looking back on it, I shudder at probably how close to the ragged edge I was, not just landing and taking off, but doing some of the aerobatics that I was attempting to do without any business doing them. Mm-hmm. But, you know, here I am. So
you mentioned being mostly self-taught in aerobatics. What was your process when you were basically learning aerobatics? Were you looking up more experienced pilots, whether it's in events, in air shows, in videos? I mean that back then it was much harder to access to information about how to do a certain maneuver, right?
Yes, and that's a great question, and there is a couple different levels of answer to that. But when I was starting, when I flew my Pitts and I went right into air show flying, there was a gentleman at my local airport who, much more mature than I was, actually the owner of that super decathlon, and he had done some IAC aerobatic competition. And he saw the value in being involved in an organized, structured environment, especially for a new person without any experience. So he encouraged me strongly to get involved in aerobatic competition. Go try it, see what I thought. And it was a life-changing experience because I went to this first contest, entered Sportsman, placed third over the weekend. And something I never knew I hid inside me surfaced, and that was my competitive edge. I never knew I had a competitive spirit. But placing third, I thought, well, I've got to do better. So getting involved in aerobatic competition was the beginning of me taking a more pragmatic step towards learning to fly properly. Because as you know, with model competitions, it's leveled as well, you know, Sportsman, Intermediate, mm-hmm. Advanced, Unlimited. So you learn in a building block method. And when you're at a competition, obviously, you're surrounded by other people that are like you, have the same passion. There are a lot of people that were there better than I was. So yes, of course, I would watch them fly. I understood the basics of what I was supposed to be doing, but watching better pilots and getting to talk to them about how they're doing it, how they approach it, was really, really very helpful. I was self-taught in that sense up through the advanced level of aerobatic competition. Then once I got into the unlimited level, and my goal at that point, flying unlimited, was to gain a spot on the U.S. aerobatic team. And to do that, it's a whole other level. It's like being an Olympic athlete in terms of the training regime. Every flight has to have a purpose. Most flights need to be critiqued, watched from the ground from a good eye's perspective. So I would start hiring personal trainers, go away for a week, usually to Virginia for a week, and work with one of several trainers. I would use Sergei Boryak, who is a former Russian national champion. I've used the 1994 World Aerobatic Champion, Xavier Delaponte, several others as well over the years. But you need someone to get to that level and to win. You need to be trained by somebody who's been to that level and won. Mm-hmm. And Sergei and Xavier have both been there and done that. So that was a real turning point in my aerobatic capabilities. But technically, it's not dual because they're not in the airplane with me. They're on the ground, on the radio, videotaping, commenting, you know, positive, negative, more rudder, less rudder, that sort of thing. So that's kind of the learning curve and how I became what I became in aerobatic flying. The Slovakian World Championships were in 1998, and that was my last year of competition. I didn't go back and compete anymore. I just concentrated on the air show flying. Air show flying is a lot different than competitive flying because you're there to entertain people, mm-hmm. not there to fly perfect figures that are being judged by a panel of experts. So while I had the basics, not the basics, while I was a very good competitive aerobatic pilot, I also needed to remember and learn new methods and new styles of flying air show style aerobatics. Mm-hmm. So, of course, I worked with other air show pilots prior to going to air shows and, you know, try not to copy them, but be inspired by them and how they fly.
When you are training for air shows, are you still usually using somebody else on the ground to give you feedback about your flying?
I've never hired anybody for that. Typically, it's just when we're practicing. You know, I'll go to a remote location a few days before a show. I don't know if you recall, I flew lead pilot for a formation group called The Force. Mm-hmm. Rob Holland, an up-and-coming air show pilot, Rob Holland,
mm-hmm. Yeah,
flew my right wing. And Bill Stein, a West Coast air show pilot flying an Edge 540, would fly my left wing. He would fly slot. Jack Knutson from Ohio would fly my left wing. Sometimes we flew a three ship. Jack wasn't able to join us, so we flew a three ship. So all of those pilots are extremely experienced and have a very good eye. Bill Stein and is kind of like the formation god of air show flying. He's flown on so many formation teams. He's extremely experienced and has a great way of explaining things and whatnot. Rob, all you have to do is say Rob Holland, and mm-hmm. His name speaks for him, for itself in terms of his credentials and skill. So when we were practicing and I would do my solo stuff, they would certainly give me feedback and make suggestions. Other people that I have flown with and been critiqued by are Kevin Coleman. Kevin is a younger, I hate to say he's up and coming, but he's a newer name to the airshow world. He's flying the Red Bull Extra now down in, he's in Louisiana. And his flying style is actually one of my favorite to watch. Not taking anything away from any other performer, but, you know, Kevin has, even though he, I think he was 7 or 8 years old when he first saw me perform. So I'm the old guy. Mm-hmm. And I know he said it was a little intimidating to offer critique to me, you know, now that he's an airshow pilot himself, but he's an excellent airshow pilot. And you should never turn away from somebody else's opinion or advice, because it all has a place. You don't have to listen to it. They might not be right, but it is an opinion and another view. So the long answer to your question, I'm sorry, is that the airshow flying, I just really got critiqued by my friends either at the show or in training, you know, the few days beforehand. And a small group of friends too. Mike Goulian was also a huge influence on my flying style and methods.
Yeah, one thing that is pretty interesting to me, like most of my background is obviously in RC, I tend to be pretty self-critical anytime I do either a competition or any demo flight, any type of airshow. I'm pretty much in the same position as the spectators, right? I'm looking at the plane from the same point of view as them. I think for you it's very different, right? Would you go after an airshow and take a look at the video to see how your flight went to get a better idea? Or do you feel that with your experience at that point, you are able to have a pretty good idea of, okay, yeah, I messed up this this role, I went a bit over, this wasn't presented the best it could. Like, do you ever go back and try to look at your flights from that spectator perspective?
Yes, I did. Not always. It's not always possible to have somebody on the on the ground filming you. When there was somebody there and they offered video, I would certainly look at it. But I think your comment about at a certain point with my experience level, in my later years, in my last 15, say, my last 15 or so or 20 years of airshow flying, I was at the level where, yes, I could very much self-critique an airshow performance. Not so with competition. It's very difficult to self-critique competition. But the airshow side of flying is... it's easier to self-critique. And again, you're not flying for precision per se. Although my goal when I flew an air show was to always fly precisely and always fly very crisp and very, very, the word is escaping me. I never wanted to fly in a sloppy manner or in a lazy manner. When you watch Michael Goulian fly, it's like watching lightning in a bottle. He moves the airplane from here to here to here so crisply and so quickly and so precisely, you can see that he is or was a world-class aerobatic competitor. And he has carried that through into his performance, as does Rob Holland. So I always wanted to have that edge and that level of perfection when I performed. But that in itself is not very, very entertaining. So you have to link that with, you know, the tumbles and the twists and the gyroscopics and whatnot. So when I did a 4-point roll or whatever series of rolls I was doing, I always knew when I was on and going really well, and I always knew when I was having a bad day and it just sucked, you know? and the problem is when you start an airshow routine, and this is a great story, and I hope he wouldn't mind me telling it.
Go for it.
When you start an airshow routine and your first maneuver sucks and you screw it up, it just gets you off on the wrong foot. And you're just, and the rest of the routine, it's just like, you're just slogging through it going, oh, I just can't wait.
You're still thinking of the previous one.
Over. Yeah. But we all know who Sean D. Tucker is. Arguably one of the best, if not the best, world famous anyway, airshow pilot, now retired along with me. Sean came screaming into the box to do his opening maneuver, and he went, wah, 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 and he stopped, and he flew away, climbed back up, you know, in front of thousands of people. Dove back in and started and did the same maneuver over, and he kept going and did his normal routine. Turned out, he screwed up his opening maneuver, and he said, you can't continue. Stop, get it right. And that takes a lot of confidence to be able to stop in your opening maneuver in front of an Oshkosh audience, say, and start over. Because what he's doing is saying, I just screwed up, and I want to redo. And I'll tell you what, in a sport as potentially dangerous as we're in, that's not a bad approach. You screw something up, stop what you're doing, regain your composure or whatever you need to regain, reset, and do it again. So
yeah, you don't want to carry that like bad mindset have your mind somewhere else when you're performing the rest of the routine.
Right. Now, go back a few years or relate this to an IMAC competitor or an IAC competitor. You screw up your opening maneuver, you got to continue because you're in front of judges.
Yeah, it's difficult. I bet it's difficult. I'm curious, you were talking before about how you don't do much IMAC type flying in RC because you find it very difficult. I'm guessing that a big part of that difficulty comes from like the very different perspective, right? Do you see, like, what are the main things that you would say make full scale aerobatics harder than RC? I imagine that the physical demands are obviously much, much greater. That's obvious.
Well, and that was going to be my response, the physical side of it. It again, on the unlimited level, and for some, even on the sportsman level, it can be very physically tiring, very draining. So that from that aspect, some aircraft are physically difficult, control pressure wise to fly. Super decathlons are heavy airplanes. It takes strength to fly them. Not so much that you have to be a Arnold Schwarzenegger or anything like that, but so I'd say that probably is the biggest challenge with full scale. Not to mention cost. Cost is just stupid expensive anymore. But not to diminish the expense of a competitive IMAC airplane today. And I mean, I know many of my friends, they have an IMAC airplane and it's their baby for 2 or 3 years. And if they lose it, that it's a huge loss to them. And I respect them for, you know, keeping that airplane safe and keeping it airworthy and still training, because you have to train hard. So you always have to put your equipment at risk. So the physical side and the expense, I think, are two very challenging aspects of full scale. From my perspective of the modeling, it's not that I don't feel I can do it. It's a matter of my time and my willingness to make the time to go out and practice on a regular basis. I did that for about 3 or 4 months, training for an IMAC contest, my first one, and I got surprisingly good in sportsman. I was training to what I thought was proper IMAC requirements, but I got really good, and I probably flew 3 or 4 flights every time I went out, 3 times a week, you know, probably. A little bit of a rude awakening when I got to the contest, and on my first flight, the judges were laughing at my flying, but that's a whole other story. and equate that to Chase and how much flying he has to do to get to the level where he is and then maintain it. And really, it just, my lifestyle with the air shows and work as an airline pilot, I just could never really make the commitment to fly that much on a regular basis to stay good and keep advancing. And when I'm in the real airplane flying aerobatics, it's what I'm doing with the controls, the rudder, the throttle, the stick. 85 to 90% of what I'm doing is just innate. It's natural movement because of my years and years of doing it. And I don't know what I'm doing specifically. So when I translate it to my thumbs aren't doing what this does when I'm in the real plane.
You need to retrain yourself.
I imagine you would get good
faster than the average person just because you have a lot of very similar kind of movements that you understand what the airplane needs to do or what the airplane is going to do when you put it in a certain position. But yeah, I guess that you have to train all over again until you feel that level of you're not thinking about it anymore, right?
Yes. And to a perfect example, the first time I flew, I had an RC, I had a Hangar 9 Extra, a big one, with a DA-100 in it. And I went out to Dayton to fly with Frank Nall and some of his friends. And Frank is a former big-time iMac guy and champion. And I go up and I start this hammerhead. As I'm going up the line, the airplane starts going like this, and it goes further and further up the line. It goes more like this and this. And he's like, "Matt, what are you doing?" And I'm like, "What do you mean? What am I doing?" He's like, "You need rudder." What? And I'm okay. So he said, "Well, what are you doing in a hammerhead when you do it in your real airplane?" I said, "Well, the further up the line I go, the more right rudder I put in." He says, "Exactly. Use right rudder as you're going up the line." And I'm like, "I never thought of that." So, you know, you still have torque and you still have P factor and you still have all those things in the model. But again, taking what I do with my feet without thinking and now having to put it into my thumb and think about it was a challenge. So the cop out is, I fly warbirds now in left hand and right hand patterns.
Different style, still fun.
Mm-hmm.
You were mentioning before how when you were thinking about doing a bit of iMac, one of the issues was time, right? Like you are busy as an airline pilot. I imagine that when you were flying as an airshow pilot, you were pretty busy back then, right? Because you were still flying commercial back then.
Yes, and I still am. Mm-hmm.
But as an airshow pilot, you are going pretty much all over the country, right?
My last 15 years, I was with Embry-Riddle. I was flying air shows in California, Arizona, Washington, Texas, Florida, obviously Oshkosh, Wisconsin, a lot in the Northeast because of Embry-Riddle's recruiting. But I would do 15. Well, in the earlier days, I was doing 18 and 20 air shows a year. Once I was with Embry-Riddle, I would do about 15 a year. So balancing the airline flying with flying air shows in California in a small daytime, good weather only airplane, you know, it could take a week to get an airplane to the West Coast or back from the West Coast. It got to the point I was very senior. I was based up in New York. So, well, I wasn't always New York. When I was a co-pilot, I got my seniority and stayed there for a little while to help my schedule so I could work a senior schedule with my air show stuff. And then when I became a captain up in New York, I sat in the junior airplane at the junior base so that I could have the seniority to do my air shows. And really the last 10 years or so, I was probably dropping or not flying half of my airline schedule to accommodate my air show schedule. A lot of people might think that was not smart financially, but, you know, I did have a sponsor and, you know, the air show income and whatnot made it, in my case, financially viable to approach it that way. But, you know, the last 5 years of air show flying were very, very, very busy. And I, even with dropping trips, I still needed to hire pilots to move my airplane to and from air shows for me. And then I would have an airline ticket and fly to the air show, do the show, airline home, go to work. So very often I was getting home from a trip on a Wednesday or Thursday night, packing my bags and on the road Thursday morning or Friday morning to the next air show, getting home from that air show Sunday or Monday and going right back out to work. So it had its moments.
Yeah. One of the first times I believe I heard your name for the first time was probably when Great Plains released that, I think it was at 1/3 scale of your cap, the Eagle 580. Mm-hmm. How did you get involved in that project?
Was that the paintball scheme?
Yep.
Okay. Well, there was one version of my airplane prior to that. That was done by Hangar 9. That was the blue and green scheme. That was quite popular for its day. Mike McConville designed that airplane for Hangar 9. It was a big hit. But I had been recruited by Futaba to be a Team Futaba pilot. Futaba, of course, was the brand that Hobbyco carried. Hobbyco also being a Great Plains, or Great Plains being a brand of Hobbyco. I was fortunate enough to meet a lot of the executives and owners of the Hobbyco company, one of them being Great Plains founder Don Anderson. He was always the guy in the box holding the model. And they approached me about doing a model for them or with them, which I was interested in, of course, but another cap in blue and green. I mean, they were already kind of done to death. So we agreed that it would be fun if we collectively designed a paint scheme, a paint design for the airplane, for my real airplane, and model it as the kit and launch them at the same time as a, here's the new airplane, here's the new model of it. No one's going to have it out on the market. So we did that. We sat down. I had a marketing company, a design company here in Philadelphia, come up with that paint scheme with all the splats and the big bullseye on the bottom. And we flew to Champaign to present it to the design team and R&D team at Hobbyco and Great Plains. And we slid that picture across the table to everybody, and they all looked at it and went, oh, this is impossible. We can't do this. But to their credit, they did. And I think they knocked it out of the park. And because it was an ARF, it was already covered in a very complicated scheme. And in those days, they didn't have printed.
Yeah, it was not the painted cover. It was it's the individual color. It's a different piece of covering.
Yeah. So they did it. They knocked it out of the park. And while they're doing that side of the business, my airplane is in Michigan getting stripped and sanded and primed and painted. And we went out there with projectors and clear celluloid sheets with the design on them. We put them in the projector and project it onto the airplane where we want it. Then we take our fine line tape and start masking. It was a nightmare paint job. But it's a memorable paint design. People either loved it or they hated it. And I don't think there were many people in between.
In between.
Yeah.
Looks pretty cool. It's very different from the typical scheme for either a RC or a full-scale airplane. So it's definitely original.
And that's what we were shooting for in that design, is to be something completely different, never seen before. And I think we succeeded.
Yeah, definitely. I agree. I think especially if you are aiming for something that is very recognizable, right? So that when somebody sees, for example, the Great Plains version in the RC field, they say, oh, that's Matt Chapman's color scheme, right? That there's no doubt about it.
Yep. The one thing that was really, that really sucked, you know, once Facebook became a thing over the years, every now and then and I'm on a lot of RC, a lot of my friends, you know, that I don't know, but friends of mine on Facebook, you know, they post pictures of their Matt Chapman Cap 580 all crushed and crashed and the wings broken. And I just look at it and go, oh, that's not a good sight. But yeah. you'd see a good crash of the Cap 580 at least once a month on Facebook. So,
yeah, I mean, I never got the chance to fly it, but I saw a lot of them online. It seemed to be like a pretty popular plane. I think people actually liked, not just the look, but I think the flying seemed to work out pretty well for that time.
I think it was for the time, yes.
Yeah, things have definitely evolved since then. The other time I remember pretty clearly your name from is seeing you fly this tandem demo flights with Frank Knoll. Mm-hmm. You flying, I believe, your cap also, right? Like the full scale
yes.
cap. I'm Frank flying probably a Carden Extra, some RC, Gen Scale RC aerobatic plane, most likely a Carden. Yep. That was pretty cool. I don't think I've ever seen anything like that.
Where did you see that? Do you recall?
I believe it was Extreme Flight Championships, maybe 2014, possibly.
Would that have been in Muncie?
Probably.
Okay, yeah. The first time we did that, it was at, I want to say, the first or second XFC mm-hmm. at Waco Field in Troy, Ohio. They invited me out there to be a halftime show mm-hmm. for the model contest or demonstration. And Frank said, hey, I have this idea. And he said, how about if you do a basic loop roll hammerhead type routine and I'm going to mirror you with my plane? And I'm just like, no, that's so stupid. This is not going to work. I don't know what you're thinking. I'm not really interested. And he said, no, trust me. This will be cool. I've been thinking about it. And I mean, I'm his employee for the weekend and he's paying me to be there. So I went, all right, whatever. So I did my air show routine and we had drawn up that basic routine back and forth, simple enough. And I came in about 500 feet and started the loop. And I look over and I see this little model way out there in the distance. I'm going, okay, this is stupid. land, everybody's like, oh my God, that was amazing. And I'm like, sure. And they showed me the videotape of it. I was blown away. I mean, it looked like two airplanes in formation, wingtip to wingtip, 80% of the time.
With the right perspective, you can get something pretty good. I imagine that for you, you would be probably leading the formation. You're doing the thing. Frank is just following
exactly.
you on the right position, so it looks like you both are pretty close to each other.
Yep. And of course, the closer you are to where Frank is standing controlling the airplane, the better it's going to look to you all the mm-hmm. time. If you're off to one side, it's not going to look good to the same as it would to the middle or the left side. But we ended up doing that at several places. In fact, I think the highlight was we were able to do that at Oshkosh one year. And again, it got a very, very good reception at Oshkosh from the people. They were like, we don't believe what we just saw. In fact, the FAA was there. We had to do jump through a lot of hoops with the FAA because it's something they're not really familiar with. So we had to do a lot of briefing with them, so they knew exactly what we were doing. And when we landed, they really thought, I mean, the FAA they really thought we were 3 feet apart. And I'm like, I'm assuring them we are
nowhere close there.
1,000 feet apart. And that there's not a chance that Frank could ever hit me. I mean, he could, but
you would have to try really, really hard. Yeah.
Hit me. It's not like he would be following me in these maneuvers. Because I would always use the base for that demonstration. I would always fly at 500 feet, my lowest altitude. Because, you know, if Frank is here, he's looking up. So, you know, his airplane, to make it look right, has to be, you know, 200 feet.
Yeah, so, like half the altitude.
Yeah, so we were never very close. But it was fun to do. That was actually very fun. And I've had the opportunity to also do that at my local air show with a really respected pilot in our area, Dave Malchione Jr. He did it twice, I think, at our local air show. Actually, 4 times, and did a great job. Kike Salmanzini did it with the biplane. I don't know if it was a Python. It was a Pitts Model 12 derivative. Yeah. And he did that at Sun and Fun with me, and he thought that was the greatest. And then Mike McConville got to try it up at a RC, the main jet rally that Ray Labonte puts on, mm-hmm. used to put on every year. So Mike got to do it with a big extra, and he had a ball too. So,
oh, so you've done a lot of this then. I didn't realize you had so many.
Yeah. So I think what that might tell you is that, I mean, we had exceptional pilots doing it, but I think it probably bothered Frank a little bit because he wanted everyone to think only he could do it.
Well, he came up with the idea, so
he did come up
with the credit.
It is his idea, and nobody else really was able to copy it. And I know a couple full scale performers that have tried it in the past or tried it since that didn't have any luck with it. So just the way we approached it, it just worked. It came together.
I'm surprised there's not some crazy Red Bull video out there doing this. They are always doing these kind of things.
I know.
With cool GoPro footage. It seems like the perfect opportunity for that.
It would be, wouldn't it?
The other, I imagine, highlight might have been Blue Angels. I saw a few years back, you got to do some formation flying with them. How did that go?
The first... Gosh, it's all coming. It's all a blur right now. But yes, I was at Oshkosh, and I was invited to fly in formation with number 5 and number 6, the solo jets, in formation over Oshkosh. We did circles, and we got just a couple amazing photographs of me doing that. The cool story there is the number 5 pilot, the lead solo pilot, Frank Weiser, Walleye, an exceptional pilot. I mean, well, all Blue Angel pilots are exceptional pilots. Super nice man. We did the briefing and he did the whole thing. Well, my claim to fame now is knowing Frank Weiser. He was the F-18 pilot that did all the low-level flying for the Top Gun movie.
Oh, wow.
He did all the low-level stuff, and he and one other pilot, but Frank was one of the two pilots that would do all the flying with Tom Cruise in the F-18. So I can now say I know him, a Hollywood star. And then to further that, and I hope I'm not getting ahead of your questions, 2019 was my last year of performing. I retired at the end of the year, and my last show happened to be NAS Pensacola, which is the Blue Angels home base. And I was invited by the commanding officer of the Blue Angels to fly with them in one of their practice shows before the weekend show. So I got to ride with the Blue Angels in slot in the airplane through a full air show demonstration.
How was that?
It was amazing. Truly amazing. You watch them from the ground and you go, wow, that's really good. It's really cool. They're really close. And when you sit in the back of that airplane for their opening diamond in review, you know, the advertised 18 inches wingtip separation, they're lying to you. It's more like about 6-inch separation. I mean, their missile rails at times were this far away from each other. I was in slot, but for perspective, in that turn, slot is actually slightly to the right of center. So we're underneath the right wingman's wing. If the canopy hadn't been there, I could have reached up and touched his wing. So the skill and precision was astounding. Aerobatics for me, competition and air show, I would pull 9.5 G's on a pretty regular basis. I never knew what G-forces were until flying with the Blues and their pitch up to break and a couple of their rejoining turns. It's some serious G-forces. Again, it's the same amount of G, but it lasts for a really long time.
Yeah, I was going to ask. It's not so much that the amount of Gs they're pulling is greater. It's that they're sustaining it for longer periods of time, right?
Much longer. 9 Gs to me in my extra or my cap, maybe for a second, because the drag is so great, the airplane slows down so fast,
yep,
it can't maintain the Gs. F-18, sit there all day.
Keeps going, yep.
So that was really cool. Really quite an experience and honored to be invited to do that. It's called a VIP ride to sit in slot. And along with that opportunity, you're also invited to sit in on the team's briefing and debriefing, which nobody ever gets to do. That's always a closed door, event. So, again, really super honored to be invited to do that. And they presented me with a signed photograph, and it was pretty cool.
And I saw that you enjoyed that so much that you ended up getting your own RC F-18.
I did. It's the BVM plug and play, the 1/5 scale. I was going to get an F-16. And I've never really been an F-16 fan, but I know they fly really well. I mean, the BVM 1/5 scale F-16 is probably one of the best flying scale jets out there. But I thought, I really ought to do an F-18. So
after that, you have to.
Yeah, it's pretty much. So went with the Blue Angel. And of course, everybody that gets a model Blue Angel gets 5 or 6 because it's a solo. Well, I got a 4 because I flew in 4. I had a tailor-made pilot made with my pilots. Jeff Mullins was my pilot in slot. It was his last year with the Blues and his last weekend with the Blues. And then I've got his name on the airplane. So it's a kind of a token of my ride with the Blue Angels. Ironically, I'm trying to sell it now, though.
Oh, no.
So if anybody out there is interested in a really lightly flown plug-and-play F-18 in a Blue Angel scheme, give me a call.
What airplanes are you flying these days in RC?
Oh, you know, just like probably a lot of your audience here, I am really sick. I am bitten by the bug in a manner that is just out of control. So my current fleet, I have a CARF, my go-to airplane, CARF Sara Marchetti SF-260. It's an older model, but I love it. Flies like a pattern plane. Love it. So I've got that. A scratch-built quarter-scale T-6 with a Moki 250 in it. Had a small mishap with that at the Joan Hall this past year, but it's in the basement getting repaired. Nothing too major. Dumb thumb. Totally at fault. I still have my old Bucher Youngman model that I won Top Gun with many, many years ago. I don't fly that anymore, but I'm putting new servos in it and going to dust it off and get it back in the air. Deserves to be flown. And then the jets, I have an Elite Aerosport Rogue with a King Tech 235 in it. I have a Tomahawk F-80 with a KingTech 210. And then I have the Blue Angel, the BVM plug-and-play F-18. And this month I've been really bad. I've added two to my fleet pretty much unexpectedly. A friend of mine is selling his Airworld FW190 Falkwolf with a Moki 300.
Oh, wow. It's a big one.
So I bought that yesterday. I wasn't expecting to, but with the T6 being broken, I needed another Warbird, right? That's my excuse.
Yep.
And then I also have the new Karf MiG 17 coming.
All right.
So
quite the fleet.
Yeah, that's why something has to go. I was just out at Winamac Jets Over the Heartland, and everybody, the people I was talking to were asking me why I'm selling my F-18 or my Rogue. It was like both were for sale. Whichever one sold first was fine with me, and then I'll keep the other and be happy. So I was telling everybody I've limited myself to three jets. You know, I don't need more than that, realistically. Mm-hmm. And it's the wrong audience to say that to at Winamac, because they're all like, what do you mean? You can only have three jets. You can have as many as you want, Matt. And I'm like, you're the wrong guys. You're wrong guys to be talking to this about. So they're all like, no, get as many as you want. So I currently, well, very soon, currently will have four, but I really should and still would like to get rid of my Rogue or the F-18 just to keep the fleet real.
Do you have any other dream plane or any other planes that you're kind of thinking a little bit about as potential future projects?
In terms of models? Now, the FW-190 was... I've been wanting one of those kits for a couple of years, but they've been difficult to get a hold of. So
I imagine that one is not very common, right? I don't think I've seen many of those out there.
Which one?
The 190.
You don't see a lot of them. There've been a couple ARFs out on the market, but the higher end, larger scale is Airworld is the only one that I know of that makes one. There's nothing that comes to mind right now that I have a burning desire to build. I'm restoring a Pit Special right now, a real one.
A real one, yeah.
So while I'm not working on that on a regular basis, that's taking up my workshop in the basement with the wing restoration. I know given time I'll come up with something I would like to build. I wouldn't mind building something really meaty, you know, a real project that's a real build. Get back into a balsa wood and ply model again and build something substantial out of, you know, with the old-fashioned methods. Again, something scale. But I don't know what yet.
Well, I will ask you in a few months and see what you came up with.
There you go. Yep.
Well, I think I have one last question for you, and then I'll let you go with your day. What advice? I know that things have changed quite a bit in full scale aerobatics, but if somebody out there is thinking about getting into full scale aerobatics, what would be the main advice you would give them?
Get involved. Find your local IAC chapter, International Aerobatic Club. It's a division of the EAA. So if you get on EAA.org or AirVenture, or I think it's even IAC.org. But if you Google International Aerobatic Club, you'll be able to locate your local aerobatic chapter. Reach out to them, try to get involved with a local competition, or find out where your local aerobatic competitors are. And start there. Dual is obviously a must, and it's readily available today. Get yourself a good 5-10 hours of aerobatic instruction in a good airplane with a good instructor. good is not a very definitive word, but when I say good, a certified airplane, a Super Decathlon, a Pitts S2B or S2C, or an Extra. There are a lot of home-built airplanes out there, Skybolts and Stardusters and things like that. You don't know what the quality of construction is. You don't know how it was built. You don't know how they handle. You don't know how good the pilot is that's flying it. There's a lot of unknowns. I'm not saying they're not safe. I'm not saying the pilots that fly them aren't safe. I'm just saying it's another level of safety that you can provide yourself by only flying in a certified airplane. No guarantees. They too have to be well maintained and flown by a competent pilot. Competent pilot. Just because you're an air show pilot doesn't mean you're good. Just means you're an air show pilot. Doesn't mean you're qualified to teach well and safely. So ask around. Ask the people that you know if this is a good pilot. Ask what his credentials are. If he's flying in advanced or unlimited competition, chances are he's very good. He or she is very good and able to teach safely. The problem in learning aerobatics or getting into aerobatics, quite honestly, is the cost. I think one of the best bang for your buck airplanes, if you're looking to buy an airplane, once you learn aerobatics and decide it's something you want to pursue, the Christian Eagle is a wonderful airplane, very capable, two seats, so you can still receive some dual instruction if you need it. You can share it with your friends as well, you know, by giving rides and sharing your love of aerobatics, spreading it a little bit. The components were factory built, so there's a quality control in the Christian Eagle there that there's a lot of standard parts in this airplane. And they're affordable. I mean, you can get a Christian Eagle for, this is a ton of money, I know, but you can get a Christian Eagle for $65,000, $70,000. Whereas an Extra, it's going to run you pre-owned $350,000 to $400,000, and a new one's going to be $500,000. So it's unfortunately prohibitively expensive for a lot of people. Super Decathlons, you can buy those on the market as well for probably 80s and up. Just get yourself surrounded by people that know what they're doing, know what they're talking about, and don't just hop in anybody's airplane because they say they can show you some aerobatic stuff. I know a lot of people that have gotten hurt doing that. So it's a challenge, but if you love it, and you can persevere a little bit, it's well worth your time to get involved with aerobatics. And there are a lot of good aerobatic cool schools now too. You know, Sean Tucker has one. Mm-hmm. I think Michael Goulian has an airplane at his flight school, where his instructors can teach now. There's several in Florida. There's some schools out in the Phoenix, Tucson area. So you can find them. You can find them, but you have to look.
Yeah, I've seen a lot more of that lately. Still not cheap, but I imagine that once you get into aerobatics and you're spending the kind of money that you would be spending, that type of money that goes towards instruction, quality instruction, is definitely worth it.
Mm-hmm.
Cool. Well, that is all for today, I think. Thank you so much, Matt.
Oh, my pleasure. I really appreciate the invitation and your perseverance in working with my crazy schedule. I apologize for not being able to do this a couple weeks ago, and thanks for your patience this morning while I figure out where I can get a decent Wi-Fi signal.
Yeah, no, my pleasure. It was really, really fun chatting with you.
Likewise.
All right. Take care, Matt.
Thank you.